PPI.org. And this, you're tuned to KFAI 90.3. This is Disability and Progress. We bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. This is KFAI.org. And if you're trying to listen to the radio, but tuned in via web, you will find that we are not on the air right now, but we are online. We are web-based and we are still streaming loud and proud because the IDS Tower had a little bit of a flood in the Twin Cities, and they shut down the electronics. Something about, who knows, maybe they were worried about electrocution. I'm not sure. Anyway, my name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Charlene Dahl is my research woman. Hello, Charlene.
Good evening, everyone.
There you go. Tonight, we're speaking with Peter Altschul. Peter is speaking with us on how the book that he wrote, Riding Elephants, Creating Common Ground, Where Contention Rules, can help people unite and advocate. Good evening, Peter.
Good evening. Thank you for inviting me again to the show. I love your theme music. It's awesome.
Oh, you know what it's from?
No.
It's from the Nickelodeon Wild Thornberries.
Well, I am not a Nickelodeon guy, and I love the music. So
well,
when I say I'm not a Nickelodeon,
you.
I never watched the cable channel. So you know,
I love that theme music.
It's fabulous.
Need to have a built-in kid around the house, then you'll watch it.
That's true. Yeah, my kids are like 10 years too old for that. So or 20 or something in some cases. Yeah. So anyway, I'm delighted to be on the show.
Thank you very much. I want to do just a little bit of housekeeping to let everyone know it is indeed Pledge Drive. We're 1 week during the summer where we do our pledging. Please give what you can and show your support, since we are here for you most every week and love to keep bringing you our stuff and the information that you receive from us. So if you go to kfai.org, or if you have a smartphone and you have the KFAI app, you can go on there and click on Pledge Now and give what you can. We will always appreciate that. Peter, thank you again for joining. Can you start out by just giving us, the listeners who don't know you, a brief history about you and your writing?
Sure. So I probably should start what happened to me when I was marketing my second book, which is called Breaking It Down and Connecting the Dots, Creating Common Ground, Where Contention Rules. And while I was getting that book ready for publication, the person I was working with said, how would you summarize your life if you were to write it on a stick-it note or a, you know, a banner or something? And
right.
I thought, you know, I hate those kinds of things. You know, it's not the kind of thing I'm very good at. But I thought about it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And what I came up with was creating common ground where contention rules, which is really what I've been doing for most of my professional and even non-professional
Your
life.
Personal life.
Yeah. I mean, raising three stepkids has its challenges, or helping to raise three stepkids has its challenges. But I spent for 20 years doing things like getting university folk and employers mm-hmm. together to improve opportunities for college students with disabilities.
Ah.
Employers and college administrators are traditionally don't get along very well. They didn't get along well then, and I don't think they still do. And then I was working on assistive technology issues. I was working training New York City taxi drivers and customer service. For those of you who aren't familiar with New York City taxi drivers, they're from all over the world. And so we're really dealing with you know, the UN of taxi drivers, if you will. It's a fascinating group of people to work with. And then in the late 90s, I got a gig to encourage dialogue and joint action between pro-life and pro-life and pro-choice activists. Yeah, those we got some good work done, but the funding ended. You know how that works sometimes. Your funding ends and you have to move on to something else. And then I got involved in diversity and inclusion work. And then I got involved with immigration work. And, you know, I occasionally do this kind of work. Anyway, that's a long way of saying that my three books, the first of which is a memoir, sort of talking about my life until around 2008 or seven. And then the next two books are sort of blog posts I've written around the topic of creating common ground. You know, how do you do these things in various facets of your life, whether it be in the workplace, whether it be in religion, whether it be in politics, whether it be family, you know, and all kinds of things like that. So the second book is called, as I said, Breaking It Down and Connecting the Dots. And the third book is the one you mentioned, which came out about a year ago, called Riding Elephants, Creating Common Ground Where Contention Rules. And so that's my life history in 2 minutes or something.
Well, you missed the, all you had to do is add advocating in COVID time and for guns or against guns, and you would have had the whole thing wrapped up.
Yeah, and the funny thing is I did at the end of Riding Elephants, I have a whole section on the whole COVID thing and how I experienced it and how I experienced politics as I went through it and how the whole police whole thing happened through that whole, you know,
yes,
and the election. And it's sort of, the book ends at President Biden's inaugural address. So so I was writing through that whole COVID thing.
It is quite an interesting book. You make it sound easier than I think I find it. But you do come up with some very fascinating things, all of which I think take some big patience,
yes,
as anything does when you're trying to deal with opposite sides of the spectrum with each other.
And opposites sometimes do not attract, right?
They sometimes repel in
a major way. Yeah. So the trick is to find those attraction points. How can you find those things that can stick people together at least a little bit that you can build upon? And that's the first big step. And we can talk about that a little later or now if you want. But that's really the first part of this whole process. And then I just want to sort of, you know, people may be wondering, how does this apply to disability? And I finished the book and I was being interviewed by a disability advocacy organization. And during the course of the conversation, they were talking about, guess what? Advocacy. How can you be a better advocate? And it occurred to me when they were talking about this, that it felt like, and I think this is true for other disability organizations as well, to some degree, that we were still back in the 1990s when the ADA just passed, and that we sort of had either forgotten or didn't take into account that politics, I think, over the past 32 years. Happy birthday, ADA, by the way. So that got me thinking, how do we tailor our advocacy efforts to adjust that change? But before we do that, I just want make us to sort of think about, do you agree? I mean, do you think things are different then than now? Because if you don't, then we have a different conversation. But if you, then we need to sort of think, I think we need to think a little differently.
Yes. So, yes, I'd like to talk about that, but I want to step back just a minute because, sure, I will totally get to that. Because I want to touch on something that you said, which has to do with, I believe, advocacy as well. In your very early in the book, you say feelings, not thoughts, drive action. And I wonder if you could expand on that and talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So this thought came from one of my mentors back in the 90s and early 2000s. And the idea is that feelings is the energy of what you're doing.
Mm.
And thoughts help you direct those feelings. It can help you go faster, go slower, steer them in a certain direction. And so the whole the metaphor about elephants is that elephants, according to Jonathan Haidt, who is a social psychologist, that's H-E-I-D-T, what you think it might be. Gotcha. It is sort of ironic, isn't it? Yeah,
it is.
But Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-T, it might be Haidt. Anyway, but the point is, he sort of compares feelings or intuitions, as he calls them, to elephants and says we need to be better elephant riders. And the way you become better elephant riders is through your thoughts, because you can then steer your elephant. You can encourage it to go faster. You can encourage it to maybe jump a little bit or dance, or maybe, go a little slower, or maybe stop, or maybe take a bite on the way or whatever. But the idea is you don't want the feelings to be so much in control that you are, they're out of control and the elephant is rampaging, right? And so if you're working on your own stuff, you want to sort of think about that. And if you're working with other people, you want to set up environments so we can all become better elephant riders. But this concept of feelings, not thoughts, drive action, for me is a really important concept. And it appears all the way throughout the book. You'll see it in all kinds of different guises. So that's sort of the theory behind it. And by the way, I've been reading lots of stuff since, and it seems to back it, the social psychology and neuropsychology seems to back this up. So you have the one part of the brain, which is sort of the feelings part. And if you let it run free, it will potentially do lots of damage. But then you have the other parts of the brain, which you can learn to control that sort of feelings part. And so it's a really, I think, sort of fascinating part of, for me, sort of neuropsychology.
But then you get into the other idea that there are kind of a little more people who are more feeling and more people who are more thinking. And it seems to me there's you're right. There's got to be a combination that makes things work.
So let me say a little more about that, because it's true. I think there are people who are more on the feeling side and more on the thought side. But there's a concept that I write about but called channeling.
Mm-hmm.
And the basic idea of channeling is, and I'd ask all of us to think about this. Have you ever been involved in a conversation with somebody and you seem to be talking past each other and you're really making an effort? It's not one of those conversations where one person is not really trying very hard, but you really are trying to have a conversation and it's just not working. It may be in a significant relationship. It may be with your boss. It may be with your kids. It may be with, whatever, with your parents or maybe with friends. But if you're experiencing that kind of thing, we all do, and I've seen it happen so many times.
Mm-hmm.
What often is happening is that one person is speaking on the thought channel, and one person is speaking on the feelings channel. So let me give you an example. Last night, I was talking to a friend of mine who was terrified that she might have colon cancer, and I thought. And she was very much in the feelings channel, and I really tried. I'm a guy; it's hard for me to do this sometimes. But I was trying really hard to focus on the feelings channel because that's where she was. And if I try to talk too much in the thought channel, it just would fly by what I was saying to her, and she would feel unsupported.
Mm.
Right? Does that make sense?
Right.
And so the idea is to sort of. If you're in a situation like that, just sort of start where the person is. And most of the time it's in the feelings channel, which means that we guys who traditionally are more thought-based, traditionally, there are exceptions to everything, need to think about that. If we start solving problems too quickly, we won't get heard. Not only will we not get heard, we'll leave the impression that we're not, that the person on the feelings channel will feel not heard. And then, mm-hmm. Things just deteriorate from there potentially. So, that makes any sense to you. And often the way this happens and the way I became aware of it was through my mentor. We ran week-long group dynamic team building sessions.
Mm-hmm.
And what would happen is somebody, usually a woman or a person of color or a person with disability, would talk about a problem,
right.
Whatever it was that they were experiencing. And the other folks, often white males, would try to solve the problem. But that's not really what we wanted right then. We wanted to be heard.
Right.
We didn't want our problem solved. And usually, and this is it getting back to disability for a second. What did I say? Not about us without us, right?
Right.
Not about us without us. That's part of what this is about. We want to be part of the problem solving approach, whatever the issue is. But often, in order for that to happen, we need to feel heard. We need to feel empathized with. And part of what that is somehow connecting with our feeling channel. If you're not disabled and you're trying to work with us on a problem, right. It really is an important part of the process. And by the way, it's true the other way around. If we're trying to advocate for something, we need to focus on the feelings channel of the person that we're trying to advocate with. And how we do that, we can talk about later.
Good points. This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis, temporarily stalled, but the KFAI.org is working fine. And you can also note that after this show, it will be podcasted. So, Peter, careful. Everything you say will be there forever.
I know. It's a scary thought. I'm scared. Notice the feelings channel, right? Feelings
there you
channel.
Go. There you
I
go.
Am terrified. Yes.
I feel you. Feel for it, because I have said things that I wonder. I probably don't even want to remember everything I've said. So I just won't. But the thing that I do want to remember is that we would love to have your support. And please pledge. You can go to kfai.org, and it's a secure website, or you can click on your little smartphone on the KFAI app and pledge what you can and show us your support, because we hang in there for you. Peter, you have there's just a couple concepts in your book that seem to kind of wrap everything all up to give you some really powerful tools to be able to work together with. But you talk about rubber band rhetoric a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what that is.
Sure. So we all belong to various groups, right? Our tribes, if you will. So mm-hmm. I'm a musician. I'm a disabled person. I do a lot of work on, I'm a social psychologist. I'm a huge sports fan. I am a whole bunch of other things. So I belong to all these various groups. And all groups are constantly adjusting who's in and who's outside.
Right.
And it's a common thing. It's not wrong or right. It just is. Who's included, who's not. So if you stretch a rubber band out, and I loved rubber bands growing up as a kid, because if you stretch them out and you thwunk them with your thumb or something, they made a deeper sound than if you didn't. But if you stretch them too much, they broke. And then what happened? They were useless.
Right.
You can't use them anymore. And that's the challenge that every group has. If the rubber band is totally not stretched at all, not enough information can get into the group to be useful. And if you stretch it too much, it breaks, and then the group doesn't form at all. You know, the group, the boundary is gone, and then the group no longer exists. So every group is trying to sort of figure out, okay, at this very moment, who should we include so we can get good information? And who should we not include so we feel supported? And it varies from sometimes second to second. You know, it's not one of those things that happens over, for 2 years and then something changes and it happens for another 3 years. It happens all the time. And I think this is a really important concept when it comes to advocacy. And we can talk about that a little bit later. But the important thing right now is you sort of get the idea that this is a common, you know, all groups do this all the time. And one of the things that helps with this rubber bands of, stretching and not stretching and contracting and retracting and whatever the other words are, is those folks who can sort of span the boundaries between groups. So those people who can sort of talk, let's talk about disability for a second, who can sort of talk disabilities, and those who can talk at the same time can sort of talk non-disabilities. I'm being a bit playful, but I hope you sort of get the idea. Mm-hmm. Who can sort of translate between the two groups are really valuable thing. And often what happens, especially in these days, is those people who are boundary spanners, as we call them in social psychologies, get canceled, to use a word, because people think they're disloyal, right?
Yes.
When all they're trying to do is to communicate to people outside of the group in a way that they'll understand what are our issues. And sometimes people do that, do a lousy job, and then of course they should be criticized. But it's a really hard job to do well, to sort of boundary spanner. You know, the person who is trying to convey the thought, here's what our concerns are, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So I hope that's helpful.
You know, it's interesting, because I'm sitting here thinking about what you're saying, and I'm part of, you know, some rec groups and sports groups. And it seems to me when you get these groups that have both disability people with disabilities and non-disabilities in them, that and you can communicate with both. You're absolutely right. That happens. People kind of get goofy and they get testy about certain things. And I'm like, hey, we're all supposed to be on the same playing field here.
And that's what makes, and I write about that a little bit in some of my books, but what makes for good teams, right? What makes for good, and part of that is being able to sort of have those kinds of conversations, have those, you know, and be able to work across those boundaries. Mm. And that's a good part of what creating common ground is. Musicians do this all the time. I'm a musician as well. And so when I had a rehearsal this morning, and a lot of what we're doing in the jazz group that I belong to is trying to figure out how four of us with very different musical tastes and very different approaches can play together. And a lot of that involves sort of joking a little bit with each other about our strengths and our limitations. And, you know, the joke that the bass player has about me is I see through my feet, you know. It, you know, I, for many people, it doesn't seem made funny, but for us, it works. Mm. And that's what makes a group unique, right? Because those kind that kind of humor works for that group. It may make no sense to anybody else, and that's okay. But it works for us and helps us, you know, build trust, and it helps us create a language that works for us.
You have two other, what I think are, well, probably more than that, but what I think are really important concepts in the book, and they're trust talk and trash talk. I feel like there's a lot of trash going on lately with talking.
Yes. Yeah.
So give us some examples and why or why not you do use them and what are when it's appropriate.
Well, that's of course the $64 billion question, mm. right? When is it appropriate? So, but let's talk about what trash talk is and what trust talk is, mm-hmm. at least the way I define them, right?
Right.
People may have different definitions. So anybody who's a sports fan, as I am, or who have played sports, and I currently tutor University of Missouri students who are athletes. And this issue comes up all the time when I talk to them. So, you know, trash talk, they're trashing the other team. They're trying to get the other team off their game. They are essentially the definition I have is they're encouraging our team by discouraging the other team, right?
Right.
We're good. You're not, you know, we're right. You're wrong. We're this, you're that. Okay. And, you know, there is a place for that sometimes, but I, you know, as you said, there's a lot of that going on, and I think there's way too much of it. I hate to say this, but much of the media is encouraging it.
Yes. You
know,
people,
media loves unresolved conflict. And, you know, many of us love to listen to, you know, we come down on one side or the other, and we cheer when our side makes a trash talk jab and you know, and then get upset when the other side does, you know, it can be and often is wildly destructive. So that's trash talk. Trust talk is lowering the barrier a little bit, so that we can, and maybe a lot depending on the circumstances, so that we can learn about each other a little bit, learn about each other's hopes and our dreams and how we work, how we dance, if you will, how we do things. And it's not the kind of thing that's either fully trustworthy or not trustworthy at all, right? It may be, you know, so when we're having a conversation, let me give you an example. So when I was working on the abortion project, mm-hmm. the first thing that we did is we would find a pro-life person in a given city, let's say New York, because that was the one I worked on. We would find a pro-life person. And we would find, and in my case, the pro-life person was in charge of a crisis pregnancy center. And then I found a pro-choice person who was in charge of religious practices of Planned Parenthood. So mm-hmm. she was the one who reached out to religious leaders. Well, very different perspectives. And the first thing I asked them to do was to go out and have a coffee together and not talk about abortion. Talk about anything else you want to talk about, but not abortion, because we want them to get to know each other a little bit, you know, their families, their other interests, their, you know, whatever else they want to talk about. We encourage them to have a, you know, cup of coffee and maybe have a meal or whatever. And the idea was we wanted them to engage in trust talk, right? So they would have enough trust that they could talk about the more difficult issue of abortion. And then once that happened, we then asking, and they said, this was great. We want to continue the process. Then we brought together three or four other people on each side. We asked them to bring in three or four people on their side. And we met, as it happened, in a very sumptuous lawyer's office in Manhattan, overseeing Central Park. It was, in a snowstorm. I remember this night. I had my guide dog, and we were, all soaking wet, and the roads were slippery. But we had a great meeting, and we talked a lot. But only then did we start the actual dialogue, and the dialogue worked in part because we got people to sort of lower their non-trust barrier, or raise their trust, whatever word you want to use, right? Mm-hmm. Trust beacon. And that set the stage for a very successful dialogue on abortion. But so often what happens, and this is one of the things that sort of disturbs me about advocacy in general, and especially now, is that generally advocacy takes place, you go in and talk to somebody for 20 minutes, and it's hard to create a relationship in 20 minutes. It's doable. And we can talk about how we can make it more likely we can be successful. But, when you have such polarization, 20 minutes is not going to accomplish much. It just isn't.
Right.
In my opinion.
No,
in my
I think opinion. You're right.
So anyway, so that's trust talk and trash talk. And I, there's another concept I've been thinking a lot about since the book came out that I'd like to raise as well, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
Okay. And that's the concept of universal design. And there is an article about universal design in my book, but I don't talk about it a lot in the prologue. And in retrospect, I wish I had. So universal design is the idea the way I'm going to define it is not the way it's usually defined. But it is the idea that those products that are made for people with disabilities, so that we can function better, are often really useful for people without disabilities.
This is true.
Wheelchair ramps is the obvious one. Right?
Yes.
Wheelchair ramps.
Elevators.
Elevators. Yeah. The example that I write about in my book is back in the 1,000 years ago in the early 80s, I got for my Christmas present, my mom got me a talking clock. You hit a button that said, it's 12:22 p.m., whatever it was. It was very robotic voice.
I have several of those around my house
for the blind,
still.
Yeah, the American Foundation for the Blind came out, and we loved it. My mom loved it too. She's sighted, and she loved it too. And within 3 years, my aunt bought a similar thing at Walmart, exactly the same product, except they probably had a screen that flashed the time as well. But and of course it was a lot cheaper because it had been mass produced.
Of course,
and there's a lot of that kind of stuff. The other example that I often talk about is. Technology can be really complicated, as we all know, and for especially folks who are blind, and even for folks with other disabilities. And what I found really interesting is I would be talking to folks about a specific technology hassle that made it impossible for me to use a certain piece of software, and almost invariably the comment was that part of the software, that website, is also very hard for me to use as well.
Ah, yes.
So it was very hard for them to use. It was impossible for me to use. And so I after that, I start saying to tech designers, hey, think about this. Don't just think about this on my behalf. Think about this as it will make it much easier for a lot. You'll get fewer, likely to get fewer, calls on your helpline because and they said, oh, we had thought about that. So that's the concept of universal design.
Exactly.
And through my weird brain. Not the way it's really defined, but for the purpose of this conversation, that's the way it's defined.
But we are still doing the pledge drive, and I encourage all of you who might be so inclined to please donate some of your funds to help, since I donate much of my time and would love to see support come in for KFAI and Disability and Progress, and to support me bringing guests like Peter on to speak with you. And Peter, I want to go to talk a little bit about what you did start talking about when you were so rudely interrupted and tilted another direction, was about the ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act. This is the ADA's anniversary this month. That is correct. And you bring up something very interesting, and you said something interesting when we were speaking over email, that you felt that if the ADA were to come up at as a starter thing now, it probably wouldn't pass. And I do agree, but I would like to hear your thoughts on that. Why wouldn't it pass?
I think here's my take on it. So think back, 32 years ago in the 1990s. I was doing this a little bit this afternoon. We lived in a very different space. And one of the ways that the space was different is that the center held. We had, we had moderate Democrats, we had moderate Republicans, and that's really where the energy was. And so, not always, not all the time. Talk about rubber bands, right? Sometimes the energy would, but
you're
the
right.
Most part,
much more central.
Much more centered. And you had both Republicans and Democrats, advocating for this bill. Obviously, President Bush was president. George H.W. Bush was the president. Mm-hmm. A lot of the advocates were Republicans, and of course, there were Democrats as well. And now it seems to me that the more extreme on each side that are driving the bus, if you will. It's the progressives. It's the arch Christian conservatives, who are not used to talking to each other with any degree of respect. They just aren't, and they're the ones who tend to be driving the parties right now. And you just don't have as many centrists anymore. I don't think.
You think it wouldn't pass today, and what would we have to do? Because that is a scary thought, that passed now, or 30 some years ago, and it wouldn't today. The idea of what would have to change with it.
Well, the answer to your question is, I don't think this is my opinion. I don't think there's much that could be done right now to pass it. Because if for no other reason, I had this conversation with a congressman last week, because it would pass the House, but that would, I can't see getting 60 votes in the Senate to overcome a filibuster. I just don't see it happening. The good news is that it passed, right? So that's the good news. The challenge I think that we have now is, how can we use that, and how can we sort of, if we agree that this is the position, the place that we find ourselves in, that we're in a very different place than we were in 1990, 1991, 1989, when all this ADA stuff was happening. How do we change our advocacy approach? And that's, to me, what I've been sort of wrestling with over the past, ever since I had that meeting with that disability advocacy organization, that it just seems to me that the approach that's being done has some downsides. Having said that, I absolutely respect the work that they do. But why is it, for example, that you read legislation that these organizations want passed, and I haven't seen a Republican co-sponsor on any of these legislation for 15 years?
Mm.
Not one. Why? Why is that happening? And more importantly, what can we do to begin to build those bridges so we might get a Republican once in a while? So, it's things like that that make me wonder. I mean, it's all well and good to have, and what I often see in disability organizations is, we have 60 supporters of this legislation. They're all Democrats. That's great. We have 60 supporters, but it's going to go nowhere because half of the country is Republican. And, unless we can get more Republicans drawn into this conversation, we ain't going to get very far.
So
we just aren't.
What's interesting is, some people I've spoken to feel that the ADA has not quite kept up with what's going on now, and that there should be changes. That you're right. It's so different than what it was 30 some years ago. But many people are afraid to touch it because what would happen? People could weaken it, and that would be very bad.
It's a very scary thing. And we also have the Supreme Court, right? Supreme Court has become much, back then,
yes.
it was sort of central left. I think it's a fair way of saying it. Center left. It wasn't wildly left, but now, you know, from my perspective, it's
quite left. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's extreme left and extreme right is what it is. And they're more right than left. That's the way I look at it.
Yes. So, but I do think that it's like the more one way somebody is, the more the other way somebody pulls to try to counterbalance.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly right. And the only way that can, and you talk about rubber, you are talking about rubber bands a little bit, you know, you're trying to stretch the band, but the only way you can do that to stop that kind of thing, because you're right. People react from the excesses of one side by doing excessive stuff on the other side, and it keeps going and it keeps going. And then of course the victimhood starts. They're doing this to us. Woe is me. They're doing this to us. Woe is me. They're such bullies. It's, you know, it just gets crazy from my perspective. And it's wildly unproductive. All it's doing is, you know, is trash talking the other side, and not much gets done.
That is very true. And it bothers me that we have so many constituents who are happy with that.
I don't. Yeah. And I agree with you.
I thought you were always going to say, I don't think they're happy with it. But if they weren't, they would stop voting for the same thing. Right.
The way I put it is they're happy enough with it. They're not wildly happy, but they're happy enough to vote, you know, for their tribe, regardless of where they stand.
Yes. You know? So it brings me to that idea that what at risk of doing a political thing, I try to be careful, but that sometimes I feel like one part of the party feels like all that's important is winning. It doesn't matter if it's right or wrong. It doesn't matter if it's breaking rules or laws. But if you win, then that's it. And there's so much more to that. I think you lose a ton of stuff if you play that way.
Well, one of the things you lose is trust. Big time.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I don't want to get too political either, but there's a reason why the trust, we had trust issues before 2016. Right, 2017, but it's gotten much worse. Well, why is that? It's because the politicians, I think more on one side than the other, but it doesn't matter at this point which side for purposes of this conversation. You know, they've done so much trash talking that the parts of the country that sort of glue us together, you know, that as a culture, are sort of fraying. And I think we live in very scary times personally. I didn't mean to go down quite this road, but I think we need to sort of find ways to rebuild that trust.
So I'd like to weigh in on here and say that complacency is rampant, and we really need to get people back in the game.
I agree with that too. And why does complacency happen? I think part of the reason it happens is that there's people are so discouraged with
they don't think anything will change.
That's right. And it's dangerous to raise your head. Have you ever had the experience of trying to engage in a conversation and you raise your head and somebody shoots at it?
Yeah.
Does that ring a bell at all to you?
Yeah, it happened to me.
It's happened to me. And, you know, that's a scary thing. Now, I'm sort of experienced at it, and I'm a little better at it maybe than other people, but I don't like it any more than anybody else. Mm. You know, The only way complacency is not going to these complacent people on your side and saying, we need you to be more, you know, active. Well, they don't want to have their head shot at. Nobody does. You know, unless you're a really driven person. There are people like that out there. But most of us want to live sane, you know, happy lives. We don't want to in politics and scream and yell at each other. And the only way I really believe is the only way that we're going to get more political activity is by rebuilding trust. And how do we do that? Well, that's I don't know how much time we have left, because we could talk about this for the next 3 hours.
Well, but we got about 20 minutes, maybe
okay,
19.
Well, that's tough. So, but anyway,
you can't get much done in 20 minutes. Sorry.
No. I understand. Well, we're not going to. So, and please understand something. I am not. I don't have all the answers. The reason I want to have this conversation, is I want people to think. Mm-hmm. I want people to think. You know, the first question is: if you think things are different now than they were in 1990, then obviously our behavior needs to change a little bit. And what does that look like? Well, it may look like different things, different people. So let me give an example of something that I thought was really interesting and not something I would do, but it was very successful. Do you remember back in 2017 when the Affordable Care Act, AKA Obamacare,
I know where you're going. Go ahead.
Okay, was in danger of being overturned, right? Voting out of office. And a lot of disability folks protested, mm-hmm. and they camped out outside the congressional offices in their wheelchairs, and they caused what do they call it? Good trouble, to use Martin Luther King's term. And they were arrested, and they were arrested many times, and they were, you know, they were nonviolent, but they were there. They were heard. They raised their voices. They caused their share of trouble. And it's hard to know how much the ACA was saved because of that, but I'm sure it had a positive contribution. You know, it got all kinds of media coverage. Our issues, our concerns were raised as a result. People got a sense of how the Affordable Care Act was impacting us disabled folks. And I think that got people's attention. And I was talking to one of these activists who was arrested several times over a meal. And notice, we had this conversation over a meal. I say this because this was something I would never even dream of doing. You know, that's just not how I'm wired. But we had an interesting conversation about it. And it that wouldn't have happened if we were, at a formal conference table. You know, the fact that we're having a meal together and we were relaxed and we were having a nice, we had a prior relationship. And, you know, he talked about why he did what he did. Mm-hmm. And I told him about my concerns. It was a very interesting and soulful conversation. Soulful is a feelings term, right? So it was both on the thoughts and feelings channel. And we became friends afterwards, you know, while we were working together on a different project. So that, and we may need to do more of that.
But I do want to point something out, though. So, yes, you became friends, but he didn't do something. I mean, he did something you may never, that's not how you're wired, but you believe in it.
Yes, I do believe in it.
And so
I do believe in it.
But then there's the whole thing of what happens, and you did the whole abortion thing, mm-hmm. with, that's an example of what happens when two people have to come together and work things out. When one really is vehemently against it and one is, you know, totally in for it.
So let's talk about, there were reactions to that, but let's talk about that abortion thing that we're talking about. So you remember how I told you about how we started the process by getting two people together, one mm-hmm. pro-life yes. and one pro-choice, and how they had the conversation, how they got to like each other, and how they, we got other people together. And then we had these dialogues. And the goal of the dialogues was twofold. One was so people could sort of learn about each other and learn how they became connected with the abortion issue and why they believe what they believed and share their stories and talk about this issue. And it was in a respectful, safe space. One of the things that bugs me parenthetically is safe spaces is one of these terms derided. Safe spaces. They can't handle it. They can't handle themselves. They have to be in safe spaces. No, the good work gets done in safe spaces, because you can't. It's much harder to show courage unless you have some sense of safety around you.
And you can't. It's harder to be abusive.
That's right? Correct.
So that's correct. The thing. People are so into that now. It seems like you need to be able to do that, or you need to be violent, or you need to. And I fear for, you know, all people, regardless of no disability or disability, for this world that, you know, seems to be, violence seems to be taking quite an uptick.
As I said, these are scary times. And I just hope we can find a way of rebuilding some of those institutions. I mean, I don't want to digress any more than I already have. I was going to talk about the church and how that's impacting things, but that's a whole other conversation.
I do want to
church is falling apart too. Go ahead. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I do want to stay a little bit on the anniversary of the ADA, because I really,
yes, please,
it's a great topic. And I want to ask, so we celebrate this anniversary every year, many of us, but do you feel, I don't feel like it's celebrated equally. And I'm not talking about people who don't have a disability, because I think I would gauge that half of them probably don't know what the ADA is. If you walk down the street and ask the general person, do you know what the ADA is? You would obviously get some people who did, but you would, I think, get a fairly large amount of people would say, the what?
The what? Yeah, exactly.
But I think also now within the realm of disabilities, people with disabilities, that I think it's different with what people think of the ADA as an older class of people as opposed to a younger class of people. And I feel like the younger class of people don't, for what I see, don't necessarily celebrate it, don't necessarily know a lot about it. And that change, I know there's, it's not a across the board thing. So I understand that, but I feel like for what I'm seeing that they just aren't as involved. Could you?
And so, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead and expand on that. What your feelings are with that.
Well, my feelings is a degree of sadness, right? Because I think you're right. But I have sort of two reactions to that. First of all, my first reaction is that's absolutely normal, right? So those of us who were, I mean, I'm thinking about myself, for example. I was the only blind person at the university I attended when I was in a college student. But I had other people who had gone to the same university, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, that there were some people, staff, who remembered these blind folks. And so it made my life not a whole lot easier, but somewhat easier, because they'd had positive experiences with other blind folks who had, in many ways, much harder than I did.
Right.
And so, but I didn't really appreciate those people who made it a little easier for me. It's sort of natural. You know, it's, you know, we just, you know, we're young people, we're foolish, we're whatever, you know, fill whatever blank you want to make. And of course, there are exceptions to everything, as you said. But my other question is, if that's true, and my guess is it probably is, the question is, why is that happening? Now, part of it's a perfectly sort of normal psychological reaction, right, that I talked about. But part of it is, we've done a terrible job reaching out to younger people and sort of explaining the history. We really have.
I think that's partially true. I also think, though, there's been both good and bad changes, right? There's been a huge, huge technology change.
Yes.
And with that has given younger people with disabilities many, many more opportunities than you or I or anybody who's over 29. Thank you for my happy birthday thing, by the way. Would have had. Unless we really fought hard for it, or which some things I did and paved the way. but now, like, geez, you can just shove a little thing in your ear and listen to your screen reader read to you. You can, like, go do a message on your iPhone. You don't have to worry about things like that we had to worry about. So technology has changed and given people many more opportunities. But I often see, like, in my opinion, again, I feel like there's fewer people that I see who work in high school, which I worked all through high school. And many people I knew who couldn't see had a job through high school, or at least some job in college. It's not uncommon for me now, because I teach in the technology community, to get somebody who's 23, 24, 28, and my goodness, they've never held a job. And I'm like, what? It would have just been unfathomable to me. So that, I think the discrimination and things like that, I think it's still there. And I'm not sure that that's changed. And I'm not sure that the outlook for people with disabilities from the, quote, able-bodied, these terms are kind of,
kind of weird, aren't they?
We have to label them somehow, because you got to know who we're talking about. So, but I feel like sometimes the more things change, the more they stay the same. So,
and that comment is exactly right, because one of the things I've learned working with younger folks, both with or without disabilities, is we think things have changed, and in many ways they have. The examples you give are, of course, dead on, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the iPhone, the technology, you can read so much more stuff, and that's all wonderful stuff. But, you know, I still work, and I work as a tutor at the university, and I'm still having all kinds of computer technology issues. You know,
yes.
So, right now I'm involved with a project with the university trying to get some of the stuff documented so we can get the stuff changed. This has been a 3-year project since I've started working at the university, you know. So a lot of the skills that you and I learned growing up to sort of adapt to the, you know, the non-disabled world, if you will, are really valuable to younger folks. They just don't quite realize it yet. And part of the issue is just what we talked about. There's so much out there that they don't, it's hard for them to see around the corner what they're going to be up against when they get into the workplace. Because most technology in the workplace, in my experience, is often not accessible unless you're working in a disability organization. But if you're working in corporate America, you're going to have problems. You just are. I don't care if it was 1990 or 2005 mm-hmm. or today. There are certain technologies that aren't going to be fully accessible.
Right.
So what do you do with it? That's part of what advocacy is about, of course. But what do you do with it? And those are skills that I think we all need to get better at. And for younger folks who are in the workforce, they got to get better at it pretty quickly.
Yes. And I really wish I had a magic pill that taught people how to, or not, because I think there are people who teach how to advocate. I mean, we've interviewed people on our show who teach that. Mm-hmm. But there's a difference with teaching it and having the drive to do it.
But one of the things that really annoys me, and we're getting a little bit off topic, but one of the things that really, at least from my perspective, one of the things that annoys me, if you're trying to get better at a skill, what's the best way of doing it?
Doing it.
Yeah, practicing it, right?
That's right.
And so the best way to teach advocacy is to practice it in a safe space, right? Or in a safer
yes,
space.
Yes, that's true.
So that you can get better. And often what happens with these skill-based training programs is you get lectured. Right. Here's how you could be a better advocate in 3 easy steps. And here's a PowerPoint presentation. You know what I'm talking about. I sit through these things as part of my work as a change agent, if you will, in corporate and wherever I was. And you get these presentations like you're missing the point. You're conveying information instead of help people develop a skill. The best way to develop a skill is to practice. Now, sometimes getting information is helpful. I'm not saying it's not. But if you really want to get better at a skill, you got to practice, and that's scary, right? Talk about on the feeling. It's scary to advocate, especially if you don't know what you're doing. I mean, I started advocating for myself when I was in junior high and high school, you know, so by the time I got to college and I had to do it mostly on my own, I was reasonably confident that I could do a decent job, but you know. Things are different now, for better or for worse. And we're, you know, that's a whole nother, that's sort of what we're talking about now.
So I'd like to challenge those out there, especially with a disability. I'd like to 2 challenges. Those who don't have a disability may be listening to this. Learn about somebody who has one. Because people who tell me, I don't know anybody with a disability, you're wrong. They just haven't told you what their disability is. There's so many people and so many hidden disabilities now. Half the planet has disabilities, but you just don't know that because they may not confess that to you because they are scared. But get to know somebody with one and find out what matters to them or what's important to them. And chances are, it could be important to you too. And with people with disabilities, find something you love and try to make it better. I realize that you can always say somebody like, go get a job and make people less discriminative, but it may not be what you love. And oftentimes people do best when they try to do something they love. So find something you love and work on changing it. And with that, we have just minutes left. But are you working on anything more with it in your writing career?
Actually, I have sort of taken a sabbatical with writing for a while. I've gone through a rough life patch and had to move twice, and it's a long, sad story, which I won't bore you with. But so I'm trying to sort of resettle in. I got to find a new job. I sort of my life is sort of in chaos right now. But I at some point I'm going to get back into writing, because there's a lot more to write. You know, what I realized in sort of thinking about these concepts that we talked about earlier in the show is there's a lot more to write about them. Mm. And one has to do with advocacy. One has to do with, you know, how do you sharpen those skills? And, you know, we didn't get to how do we sharpen those skills.
No, we didn't, in
great detail, which is okay. You can have me back sometime else. We can talk about this some more.
That's right.
Because I have some thoughts about how we might do that. But think about, before I say goodbye, think about the abortion project that I worked on. It's building those relationships. Wouldn't it be cool, and I'll wrap with this, wouldn't it be cool if each one of us disabled people with, you know, who want to get involved with this, find somebody who is totally maybe a bit intimidated or hostile to the disability community, maybe a conservative or maybe whatever, and get to know them. And over time, create that relationship, because over time, that's how this is going to change. You know, if each one of us, and I know this is pie in the sky thinking, but if enough of us got together and found a person with disability and said, hey, without disability, who's sort of hostile to or scared of us or hostile to us, say, hey, let's get to know each other over the next 6 months. I think that's how the world changes.
I think you're right. And with that, I just want to thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. And take care and good luck with all the changes you're going through. That's never easy.
Nope. And thank you for the opportunity.
You're so welcome, and good luck in whatever you're going to be tackling next. Thanks so much.
And good luck and happy birthday.
Thank you. And thank you to everyone who gave me happy birthday wishes. I so appreciate that. And happy ADA, everyone. This has been Disability and Progress. We bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topic. The views expressed on the show are not necessarily those of KFEI or its board of directors. My name is Sam. I've been the host of this show. Thank you so much. Charlene Dahl is my research woman. If you want to hear us, we are podcasted. And don't forget to pledge, please. KFEI.org. We've been speaking with Peter Altschul, who is speaking with us on how his book, Riding Elephants, Creating a Common Ground Where Contention Rules, can help people unite and advocate. Thanks so much for listening. Good night.
KFEI.org.